Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth, best-selling author and co-creator of PaleoParents.com, where we focus on real-life solutions for families seeking health.
I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, New York Times best-selling author and creator of ThePaleoMom.com. I'm passionate about improving scientific literacy around public health topics.
I like hashtags and bone broth.
And I'm just a super nerd.
Hey, listeners, and Sarah, how are you?
Oh, you remember to say hi to our listeners first.
I try.
I'm proud.
Can I tell you something? I have two things to tell you. One, I went to Chicago, and it was amazing. And you remember when we went to Chicago, and we were like, we need to come back and spend more time, and it'll be amazing. Mm. Yeah, I did that. And I ate my way through the city, and I spent the...
It's a good city to eat your way through.
Totally. 5 days with Matt. No, I did have a work conference.
So you ignored Matt during the day.
Yep. And then was able to, like, eat gluten-free donut with him one morning, get coffee with him one morning. I went to this place called High Vibe, which if you ever go to Chicago, you have to go there. It's pretty much a paleo / vegan. They call themselves a juice bar, but it's like smoothie bowls, bulletproof coffee. And like they made me, it's kind of like Picnic. They made me a collagen coffee with vanilla bean like in it instead of like extract. It was amazing. I loved it. Anyway, we ate our way through the city, and I just want to thank listeners who contacted me via social media and told me all of the amazing places that I needed to visit and things to do. Not just eating things, but I also did like the architectural boat tour down the river that runs through the middle of Chicago. Amazing.
Sounds so fun.
Never would have known to do that if it weren't for you all. So... thank you, listeners.
I am going to be tapping our amazing listeners for information when it comes to my book tour this fall, because definitely. We are starting to set cities and dates, guys, once I have it figured out. But it will be roughly November 7th to November 16th, and it'll probably be a city most days. So I think I'll hit 7-8 cities. Like, hang on for more information on that. We're just barely at the, yes, we're pretty sure this book will get completed, so we should book a tour part, because crazy town. But yes, that was one thing. You have a second thing to tell me.
Yeah, so do you remember, like, 2 years ago when I got vertigo after a strongman competition?
Hmm?
Did I talk about that here?
I don't know if you talked about it here. You certainly talked about it with me. Because you had been going like super low salt, right? Was that what we decided?
Yeah. So it was caused by dehydration is what a medical professional told me. And I believed them because once I got rehydrated, I felt much better. And what I learned about vertigo is that it's something that like once you get it, like you have it for life, it's much easier to like re-get it, and there's a couple of triggers for it. And one of the triggers is the change in elevation from flying. But I've flown several times over the last year. Like, I even went to Europe and back, which was, you know, a much longer flight, and didn't have vertigo. But I also took, like, this medication, like, this precautionary medication that they gave me. But because they haven't had it in so long, it completely forgot that it existed and did not, like, have not gotten that medicine again. And so I've had vertigo since I came back from Chicago.
Oh, fortunately, that's sad.
I know. Fortunately, on the way there, I didn't get it, so I enjoyed my trip. But it was so weird. Like, the day that I got back, I felt really nauseous that evening. It's not like it happens the minute that you set foot on ground. It kind of, like, creeped up on me. And now it's to the point where it's almost comical. Like, people around me are like, really? Are you faking this? I'm like, no. I got off of the elevator at work and I felt like there was an active earthquake. Like, my body was like swaying like crazy. I'm like, I should probably go do something about this. But I've been trying to drink more water and get some good electrolytes and try to replenish, rehydrate myself, because I know that that's likely what I need. I think that the combination of, like, being in Chicago, walking around, sweating.
Well, and travel can be dehydrating. Period.
Exactly.
Like, it's, you know, especially those longer airplane rides. You never drink enough. The air's so dry. Like, that's always my big challenge, is staying hydrated on flights.
Yeah, and I wasn't drinking nearly as much water in Chicago as I needed to, because just the way that, like, the work conference and the travel
when you're
was happening.
Those busy days.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I just... Anyway, so listeners, if you have, other than the trick of, like, turning your head upside down and doing the spinny thing to get the crystal out of your ear, that does not work for me. There's, like, YouTube videos. If you have vertigo, check it out. That works for a lot of people. It doesn't work for me. But if you have natural solutions to helping alleviate vertigo, please post them in the comments of this podcast on Sarah and I's site so that we can share them with other listeners. And hopefully by the time this goes live, I don't have it anymore. But in the future, I would like to use those techniques.
Yeah. We have the best listeners.
The best. They have
totally
the best ideas.
Do. I have two things to share with you. The first is...
Two for two.
My kids went back to school
today. Yeah, I can't even. I don't know what that means.
They were out for 10 weeks. Like, they had the full... They had their full... And we're on an equal calendar, so they get a couple extra weeks off during the school year. But we were all excited. I mean, my kids were, like, vibrating. They were so excited. And my 7-year-old, every time she would tell me how excited she was for school over the last week, she would feel the necessity to assure me, but it's not because you're a horrible parent. So every single time she'd be like, I can't wait for school to start next week, but it's not because you're a horrible parent. Like, just, she wanted to reassure me that, you know.
I feel like going out of your way, is even more of an
alarm. No offense, Mom. Yeah. No, it's nothing to do with you, Mom. It's just that I'm done spending time with you this summer and I'm ready to be at school. But yeah, so it was an exciting day for all. And I've been, my number two thing is that I caught up to my editor today. So I have been.
You sure it's not a Dropbox sync issue?
Well, that's what I thought Saturday afternoon.
I read your newsletters.
I was caught up. Thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah, so Saturday afternoon I thought I was caught up. And then realized my Dropbox hadn't been syncing for 3 days and that there was actually two more chapters that she'd put in there. But I got one done yesterday and one done today. So that means not only am I caught up to her, but there's only 3 chapters left to edit. So I should have those on my plate this week. So I should be done the editing by the end of next weekend, I think. Two of the chapters that are left are like two of the longest chapters in the book. So every once in a while I've been hit with edits on a chapter that have been not straightforward and have required, you know, going back to PubMed and doing more research. And, they've asked for a lot of additions for things, which I think is so funny because they keep talking about how this is like the longest book they've ever published. It really is. Like, there's about, I would say, ballpark, like 40 or 50% more science than the Paleo Approach, with like the entire Paleo Approach cookbook added to the book.
I can't even wrap my mind around that.
So, like,
until I'm holding it, I'm not going to get it.
Yeah, like, we don't have a rough page count at this point. Like, the joke is like, oh yeah, that'll be on page like 1237. although I think it'll be more like 600 pages. I don't think it'll actually be that crazy. But yeah, I really wanted to create an all-in-one resource. Like, that was really important to me, and it was not an option back when I wrote the Paleo Approach and the Paleo Approach cookbook, because those were supposed to be one book. And at that point, our publisher printed with a different printer, and they didn't have availability for these stronger bindings that could actually hold more pages. So this is, you know, a new thing now that I have access to. But that's, you know, that's why Paleo Principles is a hardcover, because that we cannot do that in paperback. It is never going to be able to come out in paperback because of its huge amount of content. But But yeah, I've been working my tail off is what I've been doing, to try and catch up, because, we're really coming down to the wire in terms of getting the book designed and copy edited. And you know, they keep saying like indexing alone is going to take 3 weeks, which is, a really, really long time for a professional indexer to work full time on a book to index it. So I'm at this point though, where like I caught up today and I'm like, okay, I mean, I'll probably wake up in the morning to a huge chapter, but it's a feeling that makes me just kind of go, okay, I got it. You know, like it's not really a relief. It's just, I feel like I'm not spiraling out of control as much. So that's really nice. And having the kids, back at school and back in that routine is just going to make getting through these last, I've got like 6 weeks before the book goes to print now. So just getting through that amount of time, I think it's going to make it, just a lot, just more practical. Just have, I have more work hours when they're at school and all their after school activities start up. So yeah, that's what I'm all excited about.
So I'm excited about today's topic because I have a feeling that you might get on a soapbox or at the very least drop some serious science bombs.
I'm going to nerd out on this one. You know, this has been one of the fun things for me about writing Paleo Principles is it's given me the, sort of the motivation to go back into the scientific literature and, not only see what's new, but kind of like find older papers that I had never seen before. And, it's just one of those things where the more little bits and pieces that I learn about, I mean, it's not just about what we're going to talk about today, but even, things like what certain nutrients do. And I've got some, blog posts coming that are going to share a lot of this information, but, you know, discovering, for example, that, zinc, helps tighten up tight junctions in gut epithelial cells. Like those tiny little tidbits to me are always so fascinating. And I keep learning new things that, make this whole, you know, template that is paleo solidify even more. And it makes all these little pieces that we keep talking about on the show, like nutrient density and toxin avoidance and, balance between diet and lifestyle. It makes all of those, ideas really like the foundation for them gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And it makes everything just really, it keeps holding even with the addition of all of these fun little tidbits. So, it's a good time to do a nerdy sciencey topic because this information is so fresh in my head. But it's also for me, this is, you know, this is my jam. I like it.
I like it when you nerd out too. And I especially like it when you find even more reason for me to feel good about eating foods that I love, like oysters.
That I just did that, didn't I?
You did.
Tightens tight junctions. So does, just fun fact, quercetin, which is found in apples and onion family vegetables.
Fascinating. All foods I love. Like, right? Seriously, all foods I love. Totally down.
So why don't we get to Sandra Lee's question? We're kind of using Sandra Lee's question as an inspiration for this topic, but why don't I read her question, then we can go from there.
Sounds good.
Sandra Lee says, I listened to a really interesting podcast about wheat and why people react to it so much. It talked about Roundup and why it causes such problems and how wheat has changed and why. I thought it would make a great podcast topic for the Paleo View. Thanks for all you do. You are fantastic. I assumed she said you are fantastic with a lot of enthusiasm.
And obviously that's why her question was chosen. You are also fantastic, listeners. We love you.
We love all our listeners. Yes, sucking up is a surefire way to get your question on the show. But the other thing that I loved about this was the fact that I don't think we've really talked about the sort of like then and now differences in wheat and how that might be responsible for some of the negative health impacts of wheat. So I thought, you know, this is kind of a cool thing because there's some myths out there. So why don't we start with one of those myths? Because one of the things that people have probably heard, and I know there's some fairly prominent authors who oversimplify what the science actually says and says there's more gluten in wheat now than there was, you know, 80 years ago before wheat started being very selected for monocrops. And that particular statement is not technically true. So gluten is actually a fairly complex protein, and it's actually made up of some smaller proteins. One is called gliadin and one is called glutenin. And there's actually, and they sort of cross-link and they combine, you know, together. There's actually about the same amount of gluten in modern grains compared to heirloom varieties of wheat. But what's different is the particular gliadin that is in the wheat. So backing up a little bit farther, one of the reasons why gluten is so problematic for human health is it's not particularly compatible with our digestive enzymes. So it happens to have a lot of the amino acid proline in it. Our body has a really hard time breaking up the links between proline amino acids in a protein molecule. And so what happens when we digest gluten, and actually really specifically this means the gliadin component of gluten, is that it gets broken up in these really predictable spots. So we end up with these fragments of gliadin in our digestive tract, and this is true across, you know, no matter who eats wheat products. We end up with gliadin fragments that are fairly predictable. So we know, you know, this little, you know, 200 amino acid long gliadin fragment is produced. We know this 50 amino acid long gliadin fragment is produced, and there's a naming scheme. And a lot of what we know about the effects of gluten on the human body are actually, it's really these specific gliadin fragments and what they do. So some are very good at tricking the body into, you know, bringing them across the gut barrier and into the body. Some of them increase zonulin production in people with a genetic susceptibility. So that's, we know it's not just celiacs, but we know it's also other people with the HLA-DQ2 or HLA-DQ8 genes. So we have, you know, all of these things that we know that gluten does. Most of what we know about that actually is from studying specific gliadin peptides, so specific small fragments of gliadin that we know are produced in our digestive tract, and looking at either cell culture systems or, you know, looking at biopsies or looking at animal models of celiac disease and looking at what these particular fragments do. So what's different between modern wheat and the old sort of heirloom varieties of wheat is actually specific gliadin pieces that are known to be particularly problematic for celiacs. There's more of those pieces. So it's not that there's more gluten overall, it's just that the way that the molecules formed, the particular types of gliadin that are in it, when it's broken down into our body, we have more of these problematic pieces of gliadin. So it's not that there's more gluten, but there is still more what are sort of called problematic epitopes for celiac disease. So we've still got more triggers for things like antibody production, for immune system activation, for zonulin production. So that's one, I think, fairly major difference between heirloom wheat and modern wheat. And that is something that, you know, is really... it's really followed the changes in wheat over the last sort of 80 to 100 years. So that's one big change. Another one actually has nothing to do with gluten whatsoever. So there's another class of problematic compounds in wheat called digestive enzyme inhibitors. So those do exactly what the name implies. Our bodies produce enzymes that help us digest our food. Some digestive enzymes break down sugars or starches. Some break down proteins. Some break down fats. A digestive enzyme inhibitor is a molecule that stops the activity of that enzyme. So that enzyme can't digest whatever it's supposed to digest, whether it's carbohydrates, proteins, or fats. And wheat is particularly high in what are called amylase trypsin inhibitors. So they inhibit both trypsin, which is a protein digesting enzyme that's produced by our pancreas, and amylase, which is a starch digesting enzyme, which is made, we have it in our saliva, but it's also made by our pancreas. And it turns out that these particular digestive enzyme inhibitors that are in wheat cause gut inflammation just by themselves. They cause gut inflammation. In fact, there are some researchers that believe that non-celiac gluten sensitivity is actually sort of gastropathology, the inflammation to the GI system that's caused by these amylase trypsin inhibitors. And it turns out that there is way, way, way more of these digestive enzyme inhibitors in modern wheat varieties than either ancient wheat, so about 100 times more, or gluten-free grains. So gluten-free grains have a very, very small amount compared to modern wheat. And so that might explain why, you know, it can look like gluten sensitivity, because gluten-containing, you know, most of the products that contain gluten would contain these modern, you know, wheat products. Whereas if you went and ate, you know, some kind of, you know, quinoa or, you know, buckwheat or like a gluten-free grain, you're starting to talk about a grain or pseudograin that has far less digestive enzyme inhibitors. So that's another like big difference between modern wheat and heirloom or ancient varieties. There's other differences just in terms of the way that they're grown now. So wheat is now grown as a monocrop. This is a pretty devastating farming model in terms of the land. So, you know, in this model, acres and acres and acres are clear cut. Everything is killed in that dirt. One crop is grown, and then it's turned over. It depletes the soil, so there's not enough root structure. The soil gets washed away. The plants use up all the nutrients in the soil. Chemical fertilizers are used, which only replace a few minerals back into the soil and not the entire diversity that you would get from, you know, a small-scale farming where you would rotate crops and you would turn over you know, what's left over from the previous crop into the soil to act as compost, where you would be using things like compost and manure as fertilizer rather than chemical fertilizers. And then what happens also with these crops is they're very heavily sprayed with pesticides, and that can actually cause further issues in the soil. So one of the interesting things with the Roundup debate, you know, we used to chemically look at Roundup and say it has no effect on human cells, therefore it must be safe for humans. And research from the last sort of 10 to 15 years is starting to show not so true. So the chemical in Roundup is called glyphosate. And what happens is we've got these genetically engineered you know, crops that are, you know, Roundup ready. People have heard probably that buzz term. And what it means is that, you know, the wheat, for example, is resistant to Roundup, so Roundup won't kill it. And the idea is that you can then spray all of that wheat with Roundup. The wheat won't die, but all the weeds in between the wheat will die. The problem is that there's several problems. We used to think that Roundup would be completely deactivated when it interacted with the soil. That doesn't turn out to be true. And actually, there's been no studies in America, but in Europe, they've done studies where they use far, far less Roundup, by the way. They've done studies where they just like look at people's blood and look to see if there's glyphosate levels in their blood. And something like a third of the population has measurable glyphosate. Given that Roundup is so much more prevalent in America, it's kind of surprising that there's been no studies to look at that. So that's definitely science that's desperately needed. So glyphosate does a couple of things. One is it's a mineral chelator, so it binds to minerals, and there's actually so it can bind to the minerals in the dirt, and that's one reason how glyphosate can be deactivated, but it also makes those minerals in the dirt inaccessible to plants to absorb, which means the plants don't have those minerals. I mean, we don't have those minerals, and there's actually a way where, Roundup can actually kill the soil if too much is used by binding up all of the minerals. So nothing can actually grow in that soil. So, in the extreme cases of, too much Roundup being used, it's a huge problem, this chelating aspect. And it is known to impact people. So it is known when you're measuring glyphosate in the blood of somebody, it's chelated to minerals. So those minerals are not able to do their normal jobs in our bodies. I think the bigger impact with glyphosate is that it kills bacteria. And so in the initial sort of safety studies with Roundup, it was like, hey, look, human cells are fine, which is great, except that we are about, 3 to 10 times as many bacteria as we are human cells, right? Makes up the human body. So when you're exposed to glyphosate, and especially if you're consuming glyphosate, that's actually pretty dramatically altering the microbiome. And there are now quite a few scientific studies to show that glyphosate can cause very undesirable loss of probiotic strains of bacteria in the gut. So it's like another one of those circumstances where the most probiotic bacteria, the guys that we have the strongest links between, positive health impact and having these guys growing in your gut, they tend to be the most sensitive. So they're the most sensitive to diet. So they're the ones that die off the fastest when you don't eat enough fiber, you don't eat enough vegetables. They're the ones that die off with antibiotic use. They're like, and they're also the ones that are most sensitive to glyphosate. So that's another huge issue with Roundup. So, this is one of those issues where direct human impact, still needs to be measured, especially like there are no American studies in humans that are really helping to draw links between Roundup use and health. But there are people, I was actually looking at a study a week or two ago that actually just took celiac disease and went through all of the different mechanisms in celiac, all the different things that are going on, and linked every single one to glyphosate. They even linked like tissue transglutaminase antibody production to glyphosate. So like every single thing that was going on in a celiac disease sufferer, they were able to link causality to glyphosate. And I don't think that you can completely blame celiac disease on glyphosate. Celiac disease existed before Roundup use. Like there's obviously, it's a complex autoimmune disease, but you might be able to say, given the links between celiac disease mechanisms and glyphosate impact on our health in terms of chelating minerals and the microbiome, you could say it's a probable contributor to the fairly dramatic rise in celiac disease incidence seen over the last 40, 50 years. So that's another big difference in terms of crops is the pesticide use. And separate from Roundup, most other pesticides that are approved for use have some kind of immune modulating properties. So, the ones that are banned globally, those were immunotoxic. And so it was, discovered that they were devastating people's immune systems. But there are a number of pesticides that are approved for use that, you know, stimulate certain aspects of the adaptive immune system. Our autoimmune disease listeners will probably be familiar with the idea of TH1 versus TH2 balance. So this is two different helper T cell subsets in the human body. One drives antibody production. One drives sort of attacking cells and cells that eat up bacteria and viruses in the body. And, you know, there's a whole pile of other different cell types in the immune system. So it's definitely an oversimplification, but in autoimmune disease, you tend to have one of those subsets be overactive and the other one be suppressed. And it can be either or. And so a lot of pesticides stimulate one or the other. So there's this idea that pesticides may be contributing to imbalances in the immune system. And when you have an imbalance in the immune system can't regulate itself properly. So it's ineffective. And that creates a situation where you can get chronic disease. But the other issue with these monocrops, separate from the pesticide use and the potential health impacts of glyphosate, is the fact that it is stripping the nutrition out of the soil. So when you strip the nutrition out of the soil, you strip the nutrition available to those plants, which means those plants do not have the same amount of vitamins and minerals as they would if they were grown in good soil. And there's a few different studies that have looked at, you know, changes like how much of, you know, the vitamins that we knew about 50 years ago and measured in, you know, carrots and broccoli and, you know, grains and rice and whatever. How much was there 50 years ago? Let's do a follow-up and look at how much is there now. And sort of across the board, just from these, you know, big factory farming projects that really don't protect the topsoil in any kind of way, you can see, depending on the crop and depending on the nutrient, anywhere between it's like 3% lower in copper in this carrot than it was 50 years ago to like 80% lower. And so what's happening is this is not just applicable to grains, but just our, you know, plant foods that we grow doesn't have as much nutrition as the equivalent if it's grown in high quality soil, which is, you know, not just an argument against, you know, factory farming and against grain consumption in general, but it also goes to why, you know, supporting local farmers, you know, nerding out about dirt quality with your farmer. I mean, that's, you know, one of the reasons why I've bonded so much with my local farmers is that we, you know, we talk about compost and we all get excited. But that's another huge impact is that, you know, grains really are nutrient void. I mean, grains tend not to have a ton of nutrition anyways. There's only a couple of minerals that they're actually high in, like basically manganese and selenium and sodium. But when you talk about depleted soils, and you just exacerbate that so much more. So you get this extra effect of like, it's really, really, really empty calories in the context of one of the major contributors to chronic disease is nutrient deficiency. And the fact that our food supply is so refined and so processed, the nutrients are stripped out so much. But even if you go back to the whole foods don't even have as much nutrients as they used to. And it makes the challenge of nutrient sufficiency that much bigger, because you really have to not just seek out the most nutrient-dense foods available to us, which is what the paleo template is based on, but then seek out the highest quality of those foods in order to like get the most nutrient-dense version of each one of those foods. And it makes it just a bigger collection of criteria for picking food and things to think about.
One of the things that I'm curious about, if you came across in your research, is the idea of pesticides as in multiple groups. So I see a lot of people as thinking that just because something is organic, that it doesn't have pesticides on it, but there are organic pesticides. So to me, one of the things that I look for when I'm talking to farmers is, more about their growing practices. Like you said, you know, soil quality, if they're, you know, irrigating or taking natural measures, or if they're actually spraying the foods. Like, I don't use the words pesticide, but I say, do you spray the foods? Is that something that you've seen a differential in, or how would people go about identifying that?
So in terms of studies, I think there's like three little like different points that I want to make by way of answering that question. In terms of studies, you know, the organic pesticides have not been evaluated as rigorously as chemical pesticides, because they're, you know, the way the compounds that they're derived from are considered to be inert. And so, you know, for example, an organic pesticide can completely span the gamut from I used dish soap to wash the leaves of this plant, you know, diluted dish soap to wash off all the aphids, like, or I used vinegar, or there's, you know, some chemicals that can be purchased at the store. I know that, you know, my farmers that I purchase from, they don't use anything if you know, they're watering their plants if needed, or if they lose a crop, they lose a crop. Like, it's they're using natural methods like chickens, which are great little pesticides themselves, right? They eat all the pests. They're using crop rotation. They're using proper separation of crops. Actually keeping hydration is a really good way to keep some bugs off of crops. So a lot of bugs prefer crops that are already distressed, or already, especially if they're not getting enough water. So in terms of like the direct answer to your question, I have not seen any papers that look at what would be considered organic pesticides and whether or not they have any kind of immune modulating activity. But the other thing to keep in mind is the Environmental Working Group has done some studies on organic produce and shown that even, like, I think they did one in organic strawberries, if I remember correctly, and showed that organic strawberries had less pesticides residues on them than conventional strawberries, but they still had really alarmingly high levels. And it was from the shipping. So there was literally, they were in close enough contact in trucks or in warehouses or in grocery store storerooms. I'm not exactly sure exactly where, but close enough contact that they were able to be contaminated with the pesticide residues that were on the conventionally grown berries. And berries are some of the most heavily sprayed crops. So there's certainly an aspect to this where, you know, it layers, right? So organic produce that you get in a big store can be grown in just as depleted soil as the non-organic monocrop stuff. So it's just buying organic is not necessarily enough to say this is actually going to be completely free of pesticide residues or completely free of chemicals that may or may not be problematic, or be a more nutritious, you know, nutrient dense version of this fruit or vegetable. But that being said, you know, this is one of those things where making some effort and doing the best you can. For example, I always recommend knowing the Dirty Dozen list. So the Environmental Working Group every year does an evaluation of 50 fruits and vegetables for
you
pesticide residues.
You totally stole what I set up for myself to add value here.
Okay, I'll stop. I'll rewind. I don't know how you decide which fruits and vegetables to choose based on pesticide residues, Stacy.
Wow, Sarah, it's almost like you knew how to set me up for this. yes, I think like that whole discussion is really what led us to finding it not worth the money to buy all of our food organic. I think, you know, there are articles, not just the Clean 15 and Dirty Dozen, that talk a lot about, you know, where you'll get your best bang for your buck on organic foods. But you know, obviously anything that we can buy from someone who's grown it themselves is preferred, even if it's not classified as organic. Oftentimes those people are using measures that are better than certification standards. Well,
and certification is extremely expensive. Exactly. So a lot of small scale farmers will grow organically and not be able to afford the certification.
Exactly. So, you know, to me, those are things that we prioritize above, you know, the label of organic. Now, if we're purchasing it from, let's say, Costco, there are some foods that are at such a great price point that buying the organic frozen wild blueberries are a great option for us. Whereas, you know, some other options, especially if they're out of season, become unbearably expensive. And it's just not worth it if it's not one of the most egregious foods, or if there isn't that much of a difference. So I think it's really important to learn the foods that your family eats most often and where they fall in that range. Not just, you know, wheat and grains. I think it's really super important, especially when you're eating non-gluten grains. So, for example, our rice is organic and it's polished, not bleached, right? So you have to learn all of those terms and making sure that you're getting the healthiest version of whatever it is that you're eating. And also keep your budget in mind. Like, you don't need to go above and beyond on every single thing because you're not necessarily getting a return on your investment for that. And we've talked about that on other podcasts, like, you know, with chicken and different things like that. Like, where do you really see an improvement in the quality and the nutrition of the food? To us, we care a lot about humanely raised, not just chicken, but all animals. But if we're going to have to buy store-bought, do we really need organic free-range considering it's already so high in omega-6 and different things like that? So there's a lot to know about and to be aware of, but I think this idea of pesticides being the only reason that gluten is now bad is something that I'm glad you've addressed, and it's a message that really carries over into all the different foods that are available today, not just wheat.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think we've talked about some of the other impacts of, you know, gluten and wheat germ or gluten on the podcast before, and that's definitely information that is described in scientific detail on my website, in the Paleo Approach, and coming in Paleo Principles. So, you know, for people who are like, not just how wheat has changed, but what is in wheat that's always been in wheat that might be problematic, there's lots of great places, and we can make sure there's links in the show notes to go check out that information. But I kind of wanted to end on a, you know, when it comes to pesticides, reducing exposure is great, but getting to the point where there's zero exposure is, you know, at some point it's a losing battle. And so, you know, I start my shopping every week at the farmer's market. I buy what's in season and local, and then I round out from the grocery store. And I'm like you, I can't afford to buy purely organic produce at the store. So I pick and choose. So frequent flyers on the Dirty Dozen list, like leafy greens, I do my best to get organic. And then anything I'm going to peel, like a banana or an orange, if I'm going to peel the part that's sprayed, then I'm not going to worry about it as much. So I try to be familiar with those lists and especially, right, the things that pop up again and again and again. So there's certain sort of thematic, you know, leafy greens, celery, berries, apples, right? These are the foods that kind of show up on the list and at some point year after year. So those are the ones that I try to get organic as often as possible, but sometimes it's just not possible and I don't worry about it. You know, I wash my produce before we eat it, and unless it's from the farmer's market, and I want the good dirt that's still on it, and then I definitely don't wash it. But I just think about the other things that I can do to protect our immune systems, to protect our endocrine systems, right? The other things that the pesticides can interfere with. So nutrient density, stress management, activity, sleep, lots of fiber. You know, these are all things that can help dramatically with detoxification and our ability to handle exposure to, you know, chemicals that ideally this wouldn't be an issue. Like, someone would have figured out ages ago that monocrops were not the way to go. But given that this is the world that we live in, you know, we try to do our best, but we don't worry about, or try not to stress about my limitations in reaching that sort of pinnacle of food quality. We can't afford to, it's too expensive. But we do the best we can within our budget and then, you know, work on the other things that we do have control over.
Boom, mic drop. I have nothing to add.
Sweet.
Thanks again for listening. It was a great show. I enjoyed this one. It was a topic I've been actually curious about myself and honestly looking forward to next week's topic as well. I've already got that one queued up. So it's been fun getting back into routine with you, Sarah. And listeners, thanks again for tuning in. And we look forward to being back again next week.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
How are ya? Hello.
Well, my back feels very hot. But, you know.
Don't you know you're not supposed to aggravate stinging insects?
I was sitting in my bathroom.
Uh-oh, here it comes.
Minding my own business inside my house. And like all of a sudden I'm like, what's itching on my back? And I go to scratch my back and there's a yellow jacket crawling all over it. And so it stings me and then falls to the ground where it's clearly flopping around because it doesn't belong inside a house. It belongs outside and it's like dying. So, you know, I flush it down the toilet and then like belatedly kind of like, wait, hang on, my back doesn't, because I didn't feel like the moment it stung me, it was like slowly started feeling hotter and hotter and hotter. And I was like, not cool. Not cool. I didn't go into its place. I didn't go into its home. It came into mine.
Tell me how you feel about it. Seems like you know, are totally chill and have no...
I disapprove of stinging insects.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my favorite thing. And I'm not happy. So I guess we'll be back next week. Is that what we're saying?
Thanks so much for tuning in. I've enjoyed these past couple podcasts getting back into routine. I'm looking forward to an interesting podcast topic that we've got queued up for next week already. And it's great to be back. Thanks for listening. And
we'll be back next week.
We can't say that. I said be back like four times in the same sentence.
Oh, I thought it was super cute that you like threw it to me and then I finished your sentence and then it was like...
And then we repeated the same words.
Yeah, that was it. Because we're the same person.
Oh, listeners, we're sorry. Sometimes we're on point and tonight you've seen us be ourselves. You had good a bad bug. It's okay to not be a big fan.
I don't think yellow jackets are contributing to this planet in any positive way.
No, they're bad bugs, for sure.